Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast from Middays with Susie Larson. Enjoy the conversation. It's only just a matter of... Welcome to Middays. I'm Susie Larson. So honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. We have got an important conversation. I've been praying my heart out around this conversation. It's a hot button issue for sure. And we're coming, my guests and I, with humility and with just expectancy that the Lord Himself will lead us. Well, my guest today writes this. She says, privilege, the word alone can make us flinch. The notion that for no good reason some might have it better than others offends our sensibilities. Yet until we talk about privilege, we'll never fully understand it or find our way forward. Amy Julia Becker joins me today to talk about her book, White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. She invites us to respond to privilege with generosity, humility, and hope. We'll even address questions we've been maybe afraid to ask up to this point so we can walk further from fear and closer to love. As she says, in all its fragile and mysterious possibilities. We'll get her on in a moment, but I just want to shout out and give an amazing thank you to so many friends who showed up for our share event last week. Really, your gifts, your prayers mean the world to us as we have a vision to reach the world for Jesus Christ, and God is moving through Faith Radio. We couldn't do it without you, and we absolutely wouldn't want to, so I just bless you. I pray God blesses you in every way, mind, body, and spirit, as we are all in this journey to reach the world with the hope of the gospel. So thank you so much. Also, I want you to know, we've got 5 copies of this book, so beautifully written, so convicting, titled White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege by Amy Julia Becker. You can text or email to get in on the drawing. You know the drill if you listen often enough, but we've got new friends listening all the time. Here's the number. Text in 877-933-2484. Don't forget your mailing address. We don't share it with anybody, but we need the actual mailing address to send the book. Or you could email middays@myfaithradio.com. Let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Amy Julia Becker lives in Connecticut with her husband and 3 children. She's the author of several books, including the award-winning A Good and Perfect Gift, Faith, Expectation, and A Little Girl Named Penny. Honored to have her with us today. Amy Julia, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Susie. I'm so glad to be here.
Looking forward to this conversation and wondering, we love to start every day talking scripture. Wondering if there's a passage you've been hanging around these days you can share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. For the past couple of years, actually, and even while I was working on the book, I've been looking at all the passages in scripture that talk about God's love and really soaking in those. So like 1 Corinthians 13 and Ephesians 3 and the passage in 1 John that talks about God is love. But recently, I've been just puzzling through. There's a passage in Matthew when Jesus is asked what the greatest commandment is, and he answers, and this isn't really surprising, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. And this is the greatest commandment. But then he says, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And I've just been really wondering, how is loving God like loving your neighbor? Because so often I think, well, loving God, I kind of owe God that. He's already loved me. He's done everything for me. I'm supposed to give it right back. But loving my neighbor, that seems to require something very different and ask something different of me. But Jesus says that those 2 commandments are really similar to one another. So I've been thinking about that, about what it means to really see, I think this is what it's getting at, to see the image of God in the people I encounter and to love God in them, the way that Jesus identifies with people and doesn't distance himself from people is really attractive to me and something I really want to learn more about. So I don't think I fully understand that very basic love your neighbor as yourself as well as I might think, but I've been praying and thinking about that a lot lately.
Well, you know, as you're talking, Amy Julia, I'm thinking of offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable. This is your acceptable form of worship. I mean, I wonder if as we move towards our neighbor in that way, when you put it on that same plane of loving God, where God is saying, when you love others, you're loving me. I mean, what an act of worship it is to him by tending to the very things that he cares about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think there's some I can get so abstract in the way I think about theology and spirituality, and even just having a quiet time is this, you know, personal experience. But that lived reality, exactly what you just said, like offering your body to other people as a very active way of expressing love towards God and of knowing God's love better, I think. That's a challenge to me, but also an invitation, I think.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Amy Julia, give us a little backstory on your journey and offer some context for this conversation, if you would.
Sure. So I've written this book about, as you mentioned earlier, this hot topic of privilege. And I never intended to do such a thing because it's just, I think, scary for a white person who's had a fair amount of just comfort and stability to try to enter into a conversation about social division and unearned advantages and all of the things that seem to be tearing our culture apart right now. And yet, I think, and there are lots of factors that led into writing this book, and certainly the biggest one of those was a sense of calling or conviction. I kind of backed my way into writing it. But also, I have a child with Down syndrome. And so on the one hand, our oldest daughter, Penny, was born into a world that I would call a world of privilege, of whiteness and wealth and married parents and stability and opportunity. But on the other hand, when she was diagnosed with Down syndrome a couple of hours after she was born, she also was born into a history of discrimination and exclusion. And that goes back in time when we think about kind of the era of institutionalization and look at the way that, you know, it wasn't even illegal to ban kids with Down syndrome from public schools 40 years ago. So there's been a lot of just exclusion literally from public spaces over our history. But even now, when we look at the rates of termination of pregnancies for babies who are prenatally diagnosed with Down syndrome, there's a sense of you're not wanted here as a society that comes up again and again. And so I had this child who, on the one hand, was a lot like me and had a lot of the advantages that I had, and on the other hand, was potentially going to be excluded from opportunity simply because of what people saw when they looked at her face. Mm-hmm. And we had some experiences of that early on. And so that gave me this very different experience of thinking about what it meant to be on the inside of privilege and excluded from it. And what that first meant was I wanted to find all the people, whether it's my daughter or other people with intellectual disabilities or other people on the margins, and I want to advocate for their inclusion. And I want them to have what I have because I started to recognize how much I had been given. But over time, that actually changed a lot. And I didn't just have this attitude of, hey, I want you to be able to be like me. But over time, I began to see the inestimable worth of every human being, including my daughter, and the ways in which my world of whiteness and wealth was actually harmful, not just to those who were excluded from it, but even to me and to other people in it because of the ways in which loneliness and isolation and competitiveness and achievement were becoming gods, essentially. So it wasn't just, I want to advocate for people who are on the margins, but actually I want to advocate for people who seem to be at the center, who would be, from cultural standards, the people who, quote unquote, have it all, and yet who have a lot of loneliness, depression, anxiety, substance abuse. What would it mean if we start to actually understand all of us as people who are created in the image of God and who have real needs and real gifts? And what if we started seeing ourselves that way? Could we celebrate diversity, but also claim our common humanity and give and receive to one another? So that all was going on in my heart and in my life. And meanwhile, you know, the national news of the past 10 years is also playing in the background. I'm raising small children and thinking about not only what it means to raise kids, but also my own childhood. It prompted a lot of thoughts for me about my own childhood. And all of those things together led to this book at this time.
Hmm. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the difference between favoritism and favor. You know, God hates favoritism, and he says so in Scripture because it automatically puts others at a disadvantage. You love it if you're the person whom the boss favors or whoever the leader favors, but that means there's inequity all around you. And I think it's just interesting. But God is all about favor, about giving each of his children an unfair advantage, but that unfair advantage is over the enemy of our souls, not over other people, right?
Right.
And on that note, I thought this was interesting. You wrote, "I have come to believe that privilege harms everyone, those who are excluded from it and those who benefit from it." So say more about that, if you would.
Yeah, so that was one of these revelatory moments for me in recognizing that again, with Penny and with other people, when I look at people who are living more on the margins of our culture than I am, I tend to think, oh, well, if you could just have what I have, then your life would be good, right? Like, I see the harm that being on the outside can bring in terms of lack of job opportunities, poverty, discrimination, just the sense of self-worth that comes from having, you know, people say derogatory things or think derogatory things. But then I looked at my own life, both now and especially when I think back to my adolescence, and I saw, you know, I was on this achievement track, and I still struggle with this a lot, but especially when I was in high school, where I really was rewarded for how hard I worked and getting good grades and pushing and pushing and pushing, but I also had a severe eating disorder and was very sad for much of my high school and even college experience, and I ended up being hospitalized, and it was a severe and extreme situation, but I also, at the same time, got into the college I wanted to and got a good job after college, and so kind of from the outside looking in, here's this person who's getting what she wants and what she's supposed to have from kind of American standards. And yet, when I look back on it, I think, gosh, she was like really sad and lonely. And I look at my context now, even as, you know, a 42-year-old woman, and see that there's still in my culture of achievement and success, a lot of harm that's being done. And we've seen actually reports on that in the media, whether that's like a high rate of suicide among teenagers who are in these kind of pressure cooking school situations, or we see, again, rates of substance abuse and just the incidences of the reports of loneliness and isolation and anxiety. So there's a sense of this culture of achievement and competition and independence, like fierce independence, is really harmful and destructive. Yeah. And so this culture of privilege is also a culture that harms itself in this ironic way, because it's not how God created us to be as human beings.
Oh, so good. We have to pause here. We're going to take a break. And we come back, we're going to talk more about this great divide. And we're going to touch on the issue of racism. And again, we may be stepping on toes. We are entering into this conversation humbly. I do have to say my opinion here, but a white person can't say racism doesn't exist today. We have no idea what our brothers and sisters deal with. And we're going to address that. I've got 5 copies of Amy Julia Becker's book, White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. You can text or email questions or even to get in on the drawing, 877-933-2484, or email middays@myfaithradio.com. We'll be back in a minute.
Dear younger me, where do I start? Tell you everything that I have learned so far, then you could be one step ahead of all the painful memories still running through my head.
Thanks for tuning in to Middays. I'm Susie Larson. Glad to be listening today, talking to Amy Julia Becker about her book, White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. And you have a good friend. She's actually our retired pastor's wife. We're in a life group with our pastor and his wife who are now retired. But they have the most beautifully ethnically diverse family. One of their sons married an African-American woman. One of their daughters married a man from India. Their kids look like heaven to me. Just, you know what I mean? It's just the most beautifully diverse family. And I was marveling at just how precious and beautiful their grandkids are. And my friend's eyes just welled up with tears. And she says, "We have no idea what it is to walk in their shoes." In fact, she says, "I feel the racism when I'm with them. She said she had a woman, she was with her grandkids, and a woman came up to her and said, did one of your kids marry a black man? And she said, well, actually, my son married a black woman, and these are my grandchildren. She said her daughter-in-law was with her kids driving into their own neighborhood, and a police officer stopped recently. And he said to this woman with her three children in the back seat, where do you think you're going? She's like, oh, I'm going home. I live right down the block. He said, no, you don't. This is a woman who's highly educated, which doesn't matter, but she is. She's highly accomplished. She is a woman of God. And I mean, I say all that to say, I hear plenty of white friends say, you know, that racism doesn't exist today, but we have no idea what it is to walk in their shoes. So I'd love for you just to speak to that, if you would.
Yeah, I think those are great, just little anecdotes, right? They're so small on some level, and yet that sense of over and over and over again being reminded by whether it's like a policeman who's in a position of power or just a neighbor who is, you know, kind of thinks they're making a benign comment about your grandchildren and yet are really questioning the integrity of your family or something. I think there's so much of those types of almost little manifestations of racism, and then there's the gets called institutional racism, or the systems that are in place that make it harder for people who are people of color, whether that's African American people or other people of color, to even have access to the same neighborhoods, jobs, education that people who are white and also people who have access to, you know, wealth and other advantages ever can receive. So I am very aware from my own friends who are people of color. I write about in White Picket Fences my friend Nero, who is her parents immigrated from Sri Lanka before she was born. And so she similarly is, again, comes from wealth and from her parents are both doctors, so lots of education in her family. And yet growing up with her in high school and since then, and just knowing what she handles on a daily or weekly basis as far as little comments and gestures. But then also when I look at the just all the data that comes out about if you've got a name that sounds quote-unquote white, you are more likely to get an interview with most companies than you are if the name on the resume doesn't sound white. You know, things like that that are even more insidious because they are so abstract. Like you can't even, you know, they're not personal at all. They're just broad. So I think there's a lot of racism and it shows up in lots of different ways, but none of us want to think of ourselves as racist. And I think for many people, myself included, what racism means at like the kind of top level is harboring animosity towards people of a different race. And I think especially many Christians would say, I don't harbor animosity towards anyone. Like, I want to love all people. And that's a really, really good thing. But that's not necessarily what we mean when we're talking about racism, because racism can come out in what almost seem like these benign ways. And it can certainly come out of people who don't want to demonstrate or feel or have animosity towards people of a different race.
And let's look at the other side of this coin, because there are lots of sincere Christians who are trying to bridge the divide who've also said, this is such an electrically charged topic. I feel like I can't make a mistake. I can't say a wrong word. There's so much I don't know. I want to understand, but I'm so afraid of getting it wrong because there's so much amped up anger, and you understand why. Mm-hmm. But it's like, how do we bridge the divide? What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, another thing I write about in this book is how I developed an eye twitch while writing it because I was so scared about trying to address these topics, because I similarly know that I do not know experientially or cognitively all there is to know about these topics. And I'm so aware that not only might I get it wrong, but I might get it wrong in a way that hurts someone. And that seems even worse. And yet I've also found in my friendships with people like Nero or people like Patricia Raybon, who wrote the foreword for White Picket Fences, who's an African-American Christian writer, in those friendships what I found is just, I mean, wellsprings of grace from people who say, yeah, you might get it wrong. That's okay. I get things wrong too. We're friends here. If you trust me enough to be your friend, then that means you can get things wrong. And so, yes, when we try to have conversations on, Twitter, or when we try to have conversations in the headlines, there isn't that type of grace.
Right.
But I do think what I have found and been so delighted to find over the course of the past not quite year that this book has been out is that so many people actually are longing to have these conversations, not in the tone of the culture war, but in the tone of grace and compassion and mutual understanding and confession and lament and love. And it's been so beautiful to have like this little glimpse of what can happen, especially because we're so often talking about Christians. I mean, the African American church is strong and beautiful, and obviously we have many churches that are predominantly white where people really love Jesus. And when you can get those people talking together and out of humility and love, there's so much beauty that can happen, but there's so much pain too that we have to be willing to confront and address with humility. So it is a big work and it is scary, but it's also, I have found, I mean, it has been such an honor to even have like a little glimpse of that work being done and like a little role in participating in it.
And how powerful to humbly ask, tell me your story, or what's it like to walk in your shoes, or help me understand. As you said, people pick up tone right now, and this won't be solved on social media because there's no relationship there. It's spouting and spewing. But to befriend somebody who looks different than you, who comes from a whole different culture than you, and say, I want to know your story. I want to know you. People can usually pick up on your heart in that regard, don't you think?
I totally think that's true. I mean, I have another friend who is an African-American woman, and I have had a couple conversations with her over time where I've just said something that was culturally insensitive or that I just didn't even understand what I was saying. And she's actually never called me out on it. It's things that I've realized later, oh, shoot, that must have sounded like this, and I've gone back and I've said, I'm really sorry. And she said, oh, thank you. Yes, that is what it sounded like, but I also know you. We have a friendship. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. I so appreciate that. And yes, since you're asking, here's how you could have done it better. So I think like developing those relationships of trust and mutual understanding are so important. And that's another place where having my daughter Penny, who has Down syndrome, has been really helpful to me, because I've had friends over the years who have said the word retarded, not about her, but just in general in my presence, and they've felt stupid when they've said it, and so they didn't want to say anything more, and then eventually have come back and said, I'm really sorry I used that word. I'm trying to get it out of my vocabulary, and it's been such a gift for me to be able to say, I know you didn't mean anything harmful towards my daughter, and I so appreciate that you're trying to get that word out of your vocabulary, because it is something that demonstrates insensitivity to who she is, and to all of us, honestly, whenever we're reducing any human being to a derogatory word, then we're reducing all of us. So,
indeed. We got to pause here. We're going to be back in just a moment talking to Amy Julia Becker. Text or email if you want in on the drawing. We'll be back in a minute. That. Thanks for tuning in to Middays. I'm Susie Larson talking to Amy Julia Becker about her book, White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. Beautifully written book. So convicting and eye-opening. It's just such a balanced portrayal of living in the tension of being, if you've been born into privilege, and you probably have, even if you don't realize it, or maybe you haven't. How do we live in the tension as believers and see what God wants from us and for us? Love to have you get in the drawing. You can text 877-933-2484 or email middays@myfaithradio.com. Amy Julia, you're right. Most of the time being white and affluent and educated puts me in a position of strength. But in looking for ways that our culture might heal, I find myself in a position of weakness. Say more if you would.
Well, I thought a lot when I was writing White Picket Fences about harm and healing, and about the ways that if I look back at my history personally, and I write about this in terms of growing up in a functionally segregated town in North Carolina, or if I look back on more broadly the history of America as far as, you know, of course, slavery and Jim Crow and various ways in which I, as a white American, have had a different experience than other people, I can see that there's been a lot of harm. And if I get to this point now where I say, okay, I can see that there's been harm that has been inflicted for years and years and years, and that I've even participated in that personally, and that most of the time my people, so to speak, like most my family or white Americans more generally, have not admitted that harm, well, how can I now say, okay, can we be friends? Why do I get to be a part of anything when it comes to healing if I'm the one who has either inflicted the wound or who has said, oh, no, there's not really a wound there. Let's not talk about that, you know? And I think, actually, there's a verse where David says to God, heal me, for I have sinned against you. And so there's this sense of, not that we can harm God, but there is a sense of we are harming God when we're harming another human being, and yet we also need to be looking to God for that healing, that he is the one who's been harmed and he's the one who heals through our sin. And I think that this is a place where God is still inviting us into healing and to be participants in healing, but it's a really humble position. So it's not me coming into a situation with power and with intelligence and with all of my resources and saying, I'm going to come in and fix this. But it's rather a position of humility, of recognizing the ways that I've need to confess, and of also sharing in just the sadness and the sorrow, which I, as a Christian, I'm not sure I've learned a lot about the tradition in our faith and throughout Scripture of lament, of really crying out to God, this is not how it is supposed to be. And certainly Jesus lamented, like when he wept over Jerusalem and when he even saying like the woes of the Pharisees, like those were laments for this is not how it is supposed to be. And many of the Psalms are also laments. I mean, the Book of Lamentations. But I have not learned very much about lamenting and saying before God, like as a prayer, this is not how it is supposed to be. I'm much more of a, hey, let's, you know, pray and fix it and do what we need to do to make things better. And that's not a bad thing, to be looking for active ways to change and to participate in healing. In fact, that's a good thing. But it needs to begin with that humble acknowledgement of harm and of looking for the ways that God invites us to be a part of healing and recognizing that depends on someone being on the other side who is willing also to say, yes, I'll be in relationship with you, and we'll do this together.
Wow. Amy and Julia, when you talk, you write about your kind of idyllic growing up, and it really was, it did sound that way. I mean, beautiful family. And even you were, it sounded, if I remember right, in an ethnically diverse community. And so, but you look back now, where normally you said it was all good, it was all blessed. And then as you wrestled through this idea of privilege, you're kind of naming now, saying, okay, there were some good things, but there were things that weren't so good. And you can't really heal something that you don't acknowledge. So now you're acknowledging that. Can you maybe unpack that a bit more for us? Help us understand, because I'm sure plenty of us can look back and say, great childhood. But then when you unpack it a little bit, you can say, but this privilege to me was harmful to someone else. How did you sort through all of that?
Yeah, it was a tough situation for me to look back at my childhood, because I had grown up thinking this was just idyllic. I lived in this small town in North Carolina. My parents are both from Connecticut, but we were there for the first 10 years of my life. And there were three different African-American people who worked in our home who I adored and who loved me. And we had, in my mind at least, really wonderful relationships. And I also had a really safe and happy upbringing among my neighborhood and with the people. I loved my school, I loved my friends and the opportunities I had. But when I was looking back on it as an adult, I realized that the school I went to was what we now would call like a segregationist academy. It had been formed on the heels of the desegregation laws being put into effect in North Carolina. And so it was an all-white school. I didn't think of it that way when I was a kid there. I just got to learn a lot, and I've always been kind of nerdy, so I really enjoyed school, and I got a great, at least the beginnings of a great education, although even that, one of the things I did as an adult was I looked back and found my State of North Carolina history textbook from fourth grade, and I read through it, and I saw that there were three references to slavery, and all of them were these very gentle, nothing about slavery being something harsh, you know? And mm-hmm. so I was like, gosh, I wasn't even actually learning the history in this school that I thought was so wonderful and idyllic. And then, again, learning that the people who had worked in my home and who I had grown up with thinking of as just these beloved human beings, which they certainly are and were, but recognizing as an adult that they had, these hardworking Christian people had not been given an opportunity to the basic needs that we have as human beings, like going to school. One of the women who worked in our home was illiterate, and I didn't learn that until I was an adult because she had stopped going to school when she was 6 years old. And I never got the full story there, but I know that it did not have to do with her as a six-year-old saying, I don't want to learn anything. And so I began to just see the injustices in how I was treated in comparison to other people, and to recognize that, how do I hold this? The gratitude for what I've been given, which is real, and the grief that I feel as I recognize what it took from others for me to be given that. And I don't think that's the only way it has to go. I think there is a way, especially for people of God, to live differently. But I do think that will involve a different understanding of humanity and a willingness to really share, to give and receive, to live sacrificially out of love. That is not always how our human systems get set up.
You know, there aren't easy answers easy, and I know it's tempting, as you say, if we come in with resources thinking we can fix it, try to make quick decisions. You referenced the decision to desegregate after the Jim Crow law, and you said that that actually led to thousands of black teachers losing their jobs. I mean, say a word about that, but again, if we want to fix it, there has to be humility, there has to be patience, there has to be understanding. And I know this is true even in third world countries. My hubby does work in Rwanda, and after much research and many conversations have learned, when we come in and buy something and build something and our names are on it, it's not theirs, it's ours. And they leave it. If it falls apart, they'll come back and fix it. But if we empower them and teach them and they build it, then they own it. It's a totally different mindset. But anyway, just speak to that idea that there aren't easy answers, and quick, hasty decisions aren't really the way to go either.
Yeah, so I mean, a couple of thoughts there. One, just that after desegregation, because you often in a town would have like a white high school and a black high school, when those high schools merged, guess who kept their jobs? The white teachers, I mean, predominantly. And so that just decimated the black community of teachers for generations. And there were ripple effects, not only in terms of people's jobs, but also in terms of African-American students in classrooms who did not have role models who were from their same backgrounds and communities. So, like, this is an example I give in White Picket Fences. My friend Patricia, growing up as an African-American child in Denver, Colorado, had a year in school, in middle school, where she had a teacher who called her nobody. Like, that was how she referred to her all year round. Wow. I mean, all year long. And you can just imagine being a kid with an adult calling you nobody, what that does. And, you know, Patricia, again, is this like gracious, compassionate, wonderful woman. But I do think there were unintended consequences to desegregation, which doesn't at all mean we shouldn't have desegregated, but just that, exactly as you say, good intentions that are not really understanding the complexity of problems and really empowering people to be participants in restructuring and, you know, redesigning the way schools are going to work as opposed to just imposing them is going to make a big difference. I think for many people like myself who are in lots of you know, in institutions, whether it's a school or a church, that's predominantly white and has historically been that way. The question of, okay, wait, what do we do now? If I don't want to just be in a white space all the time, how do I just ask the, you know, predominantly black church down the road to come be a part of my church? Like, how does this work? And I think we need to look for ways to have collaborative efforts, whether that's, I give an example in White Picket Fences towards the end of the town where I grew up, where a group of white and black Christians in town are now they pray together outside in different parts of the town every month of the year. So there's a collaboration between white and black churches, which who knows what's going to happen over time in terms of friendships and mutual relationships of healing and of change, because they have this collaborative work of praying for their town together. There are lots of examples of that, but I think we need to be looking for ways, not for like me to help and fix you or say, hey, come in and be in my space, but like, how can we go out together with a common purpose and a common cause, especially when we're people of faith? We can find those things and we can do them together and participate together. And maybe that will lead to those really divine moments of understanding, of insight, of seeing a problem differently. So this group, this prayer group in North Carolina, they've started just by praying, but they're now talking about what would it mean for us to have a prison reentry program in our community? What would it look like to participate in school reform? How do we do this together in a way that really strengthens and heals the whole community and acknowledges our history, but also looks with hope to the future? Because so often these conversations end up feeling like, especially for white people, I need to be ashamed and I feel helpless. And I think the power of the gospel is to say, no, you are empowered by love and you have every reason to hope, but that has to come out of humility and mutuality, not out of isolation and power.
So good. You know, as somebody once said, you know, how do you heal from something that you refuse to acknowledge? And there's just times in my prayer time where I get face down and beg God for forgiveness for, you know, the sins of this nation. I love our nation. I'm so grateful that we were born into this nation. That's through no credit of our own. We just were. But even, this is a different topic for a different day, but even the plight of Native Americans and how they were, you know, had Americanization basically forced upon them, and how displaced they were and even are. And I just think, and I've got a good friends who have a racial reconciliation ministry, work tirelessly to rebuild these bridges, to honor them, to really repent on behalf of our nation and say, now can we, let's work together towards healing. Such an important thing. We need to pause here. When we come back, I want you to talk about this idea. You write that moving outside the walls of privilege isn't as easy of a process as one may think, and it's not always beneficial to everybody that you're trying to help. In fact, in other words, there's not these pat answers. Again, it goes back to sensitivity, humility, responding to the nudge of the Spirit, and trusting in the power of the gospel. It's a mouthful, friends, but this is a worthy conversation to have, wouldn't you say? Talking to Amy Julia Becker about her book, White Picket Fences, very thoughtful, well-written book, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. She doesn't shame anybody, just an invitation to a better conversation and to healing the great divides in our midst. You can text or email if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484, or email middays@myfaithradio.com. We'll be back in a minute. Middays. I'm Susie Larson talking to Amy Julia Becker, who's written a really profound, thoughtful book titled White Picket Fences, Turning Toward Love in a World Divided by Privilege. Boy, the endorsements are just singing and ringing about just how she handles this topic. And Andy Crouch, we've had on the show plenty of times, says privilege so often involves a conspiracy to forget. And this book gently, unflinchingly insists that we remember. But it also helps us believe that in a world so often torn by violence and indifference, love can still have the last and best word. We've got 5 copies. You got a good chance of winning. If you text or email 877-933-2484 or email middays@myfaithradio.com. So you wrote, Amy Julia, that moving outside the walls of privilege, you know, you had this vision of living in a row house and doing tutoring sessions and doing all these things. And you said moving outside the walls of privilege wasn't as easy a process as you may have thought, and it's not even always beneficial to everybody that you're trying to help. That's kind of my paraphrase, so if I said it wrong, correct me. But say a word, if you would, about that, because we can get kind of maybe pie-in-the-sky ideas, and yet there's the call of God and what he's asking each of us to do individually. What do you say?
Yeah, so my husband and I have been in the space of kind of education for a long time. My husband's been a teacher for almost 20 years, and he's now a headmaster at a school. And so for a long time, we thought, okay, why don't we go to a neighborhood and to a school system in which we are able to bring some of the advantages we've had into a community that has had less of those. But we found that it was actually really hard to make a move out of private school education, which is where we were, into public school, just in terms of credentials and doors of opportunity. And then also my husband actually went through a series of job interviews and looking for opportunities to serve in public boarding schools and just didn't get called back. I mean, those were not where we had circles of connections and experience and expertise. And so we've ended up in a, again, independent school or private school setting and having to ask the question of, well, what does it mean to follow God's call here in a world that you certainly would look in from the outside and say there's a lot of privilege there? And I think that's going to be true for lots of people. Some people will be called to relocate, to actually move. And that's what my husband's roommate from college and a group of that friends from college did, relocated into a more impoverished and predominantly African-American community in Richmond, Virginia. And so that was a model for us of what could be. But there's also a model of, well, what does it mean to not relocate and to stay put and yet to continue to bring into a community God's heart for the people who are on the margins? I was taught last week, someone said, you know, in the Old Testament, the commandment that is given the most often is to love God. And the second most reiterated commandment is to welcome the stranger. And by that, that stranger is often embodied as the foreigner, but also the orphan, the widow, the prisoner, the outcast, like the person who is on the margins. And so for all of us, wherever we are called to be doing that type of work and to love in that way. Although, of course, that's going to look different from community to community, and the way that we are able to bring our gifts to those situations is going to look different. I'm a more introverted, heady person. What I have to offer is to think a lot about stuff and write about it and hopefully communicate it in a way that is meaningful to people. Other people are much more extroverted, much more active, much more able to like get into a situation and help in more tangible ways than I am. Again, we have friends who have literally relocated. There are lots of different ways that we can participate in God's healing work in the world, but we're all invited to do that and to ask, how do I get to be one little part of this big, beautiful work that God is doing?
I love the way you put that, Amy Julia. I, too, am introverted, deep thinker, and I've replenished through solitude. Mm-hmm. And I've got a sister who's got just the gift of helps, and I'm like, I love her. We joke. I'm like, I feel like a substandard Christian next to you all the time because that girl can juggle like 10 projects for people all at, you know, once. But there is a way, as you say, we each do our part. We can make a big difference. The idea is living with conviction and doing the very things God asks, because this is such an important piece of the conversation, because the enemy works to level guilt against us, and the not enough. That's never enough. It's never enough. It's too big of a problem, and whatever you're doing is just not enough. But that's not how God operates, nor how he communicates. So I think instead of being driven by obligation, maybe be moved by invitation. You know, Lord, what would you have me do? He loves to answer prayers like that, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I've had so many people who read White Picket Fences and said, okay, what do I do now? And I very intentionally did not write an action step book, because I really wanted to invite people into a story and to be real honest about my story, but not say, and therefore you should do this, or here are 10 steps to save the world. But at the same time, I did want to help myself and other people. Yeah, how do we respond? And exactly as you just said, to an invitation and not out of obligation. How do we respond to the work that God is doing in us us and around us. And I started to think about the head, the heart, and the hands. So I wrote a series of discussion guides and kind of helpful guides through, okay, what are the questions I need to ask about my own family, my own history, my own community, my own institution, whatever it is, what do I need to learn? And then the heart, how can I connect? How can I connect in a prayerful, just connect to God on these topics? How can I learn about lament or confession or supplication for the needs of others? How can I connect to other people in a friendship way, especially people who are not from my same demographic, you know, socioeconomic or racial background? How can I connect with my heart? And then how do I want to use my hands? And how is God calling me to use my hands? And that may be, as you were just saying, by I'm going to use my hands to communicate, you know, or I'm going to use my hands to physically offer help to an elderly person who can't get dressed in the morning, or to, you know, serve in a capacity at a soup kitchen. There's a whole host of ways in which we can use our hands, but if those active steps in the world are informed by relationships, both spiritual and with other people, and by using our heads to really think about things, then that's a holistic response. And we won't quite as easily, at least, we won't burn out, we won't become cynical, we'll be, again, participating with our whole selves in the work that God's calling us to do. So that's been helpful for me when I start to feel either hopeless or just overwhelmed, or that comparison trap of, I'm not as good as other people at dealing with these things, just to go back to, okay, what do I need to learn? Who do I need to connect with? And then what am I being invited to do? And that's helped me a lot.
Boy, that's so good. You're right. Ecosystems change through slow, imperceptible crumbling and through slow, imperceptible accumulation of grains of sand. Salty seas have become deserts. Jagged mountain peaks have become rolling hills. In other words, don't underestimate the power of one obedient step, one convicted step after another. I've cast a vision, if you would, there, Amy Julia, because this feels like a hugely important part of the conversation. Again, the enemy is going to level condemnation, fear of getting it wrong, being overwhelmed because the problem seems too big. But if we go back to believing in the power of the gospel and that Jesus, the yoke he assigns, fits us, his burden is light, there's a way to do this that's actually supernatural, powerful, and fits who he's making us to be, and not to underestimate the power of every single step in that direction.
Yeah, you know, I do think that there's a place for big and radical action and a place for really small and quiet and hidden action. And in fact, I mean, Jesus so often says, you know, the kingdom of heaven's like a mustard seed. It's like a little teeny piece of yeast. You know, it's so small, and yet big change can happen from small, faithful acts of love. And yet I think it's also really important for us why I've been in that prayer. There's a prayer in Ephesians 3 that I have heard my entire life, and it's all about God's love. And then at the end of it, Paul says that we are going to see immeasurably more than we could ask or imagine. And I've always thought of that as God is going to do this kind of from outside of us, Shazam, change the world action. And we just need to pray for it and kind of wait around for it. But Paul says, immeasurably more than you would ask or imagine, according to God's power, which is at work within us. So there's also a sense of believing that the power of God's love is actively in us, in God's body, in God's followers, like in who we are as we go out into the world. And so asking, okay, how am I called to love today? And trusting that that's enough. Whatever that small, small thing might be, because goodness gracious, it can be hard enough to, you know, get my shoes on in the morning, much less my children's shoes on in the morning, you know. But what are those small ways in which we are invited to participate in God's loving, healing action in the world? And then trusting that, yes, if we are accumulating those grains of sand, it will not ever by our individual efforts, but because we are a part of a collective work that God's doing among all of God's people, that we can be a part of something big and beautiful, even if it seems really small and hidden in our day-to-day lives.
Amy, Julia, fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today. And friends, thank you for listening. Title of our book again is White Picket Fences. A drawing will be open for another about 15 minutes. Text 877-93-FAITH or email middays@myfaithradio.com. Meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this Middays with Susie Larson podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of Middays with Susie Larson.